This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Poonam Verma. Now on the show today, we talk to one man who works with the one and only Dr. Joe Dispenza and finding out how our thoughts can change our reality. Christina is an author who wrote a book after having quite a serious illness. And as I like to say, from one breakdown comes a breakthrough. So she shares her journey with us. Now, do you feel like you have not enough time and you don't know how to balance it out? We have mindset coach Flora in the studio helping us with some tips. And talking about tips, we have one lady who is starting workshops to help women maintain their cars. That's from your oil change to your tire change. And don't forget, every Wednesday, it's Pets and Vets. And Dr. Inam joins us in the studio today. Now, in 1986, Dr. Joe Dispenza says he was in a serious cycling accident that left him with 6 compressed vertebrae. Doctors told him he may never walk again. And instead of having surgery, which was recommended, he decided to check himself out of the hospital, go home, and reconstruct his whole vertebra in his back with his mind. How he figured this out, nobody knows, but over the next few weeks, he went through ups and downs trying to focus on fixing his back, and miraculously, it worked. He now has a new film out called The Source, and here's a sneak peek of the trailer.
Whatever these individuals did was able to change the biology of a cancer cell in a dish.
By the end of that meditation, I didn't need the wheelchair at all.
He said, Charlie, there's no cancer. There was nothing, it was zero.
It was like having a second chance at life.
I want to be part of that community that believes in possibility, that believes we're greater than we think, more unlimited than we could ever dream. And all I offer people is my greatest understanding of the truth.
We have just scratched the surface. This is just the beginning to understanding our human potential.
That was a clip from Dr. Joe Dispenza's new film called The Source, coming out very soon. And one man who's part of the research team for the film and also works alongside Dr. Joe Dispenza himself and is part of the NeuroChange Solutions program is Sadiq Abakstay. He spends most of his time on a plane traveling, but today he's in the studio with us. How are you, Sadiq?
Very good, thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, you do assist side by side with Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Yes, I'm a green hat, which is a meditation assist. And so we support and hold space for people going through their meditations.
When you first started working with him and you saw changes or you see people's lives being affected, how did that affect you? Like, did you think, oh my goodness, this really does work? What is going on here?
I mean, you know, a lot of people talk about change, but not a lot of people show you how to change. And I mean, Dr. Joe's done an amazing job teaching people, empowering people, showing them that the power is within, their power is within. And so, of course, we see so many changes in those retreats, and you can see you can go on Dr. Joe's website and see all those stories of transformation where people have healed from all sorts of diseases and physical challenges. And of course, it changes you on a visceral level because you don't see this in your day-to-day news or everywhere where you go. So it's really, really mind-blowing to witness transformation in front of us.
I can imagine. Now, let's talk about NeuroChange Solutions and the programs. You are part of that. What exactly is it? What does it do?
So a few years ago, Dr. Joe was giving a talk in Colorado for a group of business executives and CEOs. By the end of this talk, they came to him and asked him if he can bring this work to companies, to organizations. Because, you know, today with the fast pace of the world growing, a lot of companies, a lot of teams experience mental exhaustion, stress. And so we don't have the tools really to teach people how to regulate, how to become aware of their thoughts, how to become aware of their emotions and what they're going through. So Dr. Joe developed this beautiful program called Change Your Mind, Create New Results, where he has certified and trained about 250 consultants around the world to teach this work. And it's a beautiful program where we demystify meditation in a scientific way, and any person in any company can understand it. It's done in a very practical, scientific way. 95% of who you are by the age of 35 is a set of unconscious thoughts, feelings, emotions that function like a program. So the first step to change is to become conscious of those thoughts, of those thinking, feeling loops, of those patterns.
But according to Dr. Joe, 5% is conscious thoughts, 95% is subconscious.
Exactly.
And that's the hardest bit to get into, because exactly. It means we're all working on a program that our subconscious has been there for 35 years or whatever. So for me to unravel some of it and say, is this belief or program serving me today? And if it isn't, and I have to dismantle that, it feels like you're getting naked more and more, because you're like, once I dismantle all these beliefs, some are good, some are bad, hold on to the good ones, who am I?
The first step to change, as Dr. Joe says, is to become conscious, to become aware of those programs.
And how do we do that?
Well, we call in metacognition in neuroscience is the ability to observe yourself. So the first step to change is to become aware of those thoughts, feelings that keep us in the old self or keep us in the past, the familiar past. Once we become aware of those programs, now we're no longer the program. Now we are observing the program from a different level of consciousness, different level of awareness. So once you observe that, the second step is to make a different choice. Now, the hardest part about change is not making the same choice you did the day before. Because the moment you make a different choice, get ready, it's going to get uncomfortable. Because the body craves the known, it craves the familiar, and it wants to keep you in the past, it wants to keep you in the familiar self. So we teach people in a beautiful way how to move or cross that river of change by giving them those tools and those models so that they can overcome and become their future self. Just as you have conditioned your brain and body into a familiar thinking feeling loop that keeps you in, let's say, insecurity, or keeps you in anger, or keeps you in fear, we can condition our brain and body into confidence, into joy, into gratitude. Keep on doing that, firing and wiring that new self in, you'll wake up one day and you'll become that person.
You make it sound so easy. You know, like all of us, we've all got our own programming from our parents, culture, religion, environment, the media we've grown up with. And then how do I know, any of us, like today, if what my belief was 5-10 years ago is not serving me at this moment in my life? How do I know? What will the signs be? What will the feelings be?
You get to a point sometimes in life where you're done with it. You're done with that old self. And you're looking for answers. You're looking for ways to change or to find new ways to evolve. So if you can sit with yourself, that's why we teach meditation. And meditation, the symbol means to become familiar with. Mm. Just like we said, 95% of who we are is unconscious most of the time. So the first step to change is to become conscious. If you can really sit down with yourself, close your eyes, disconnect from the environment, disconnect from the feelings of your body, disconnect from the past and worrying about the future, and become so present in the experience, so present in what you're creating or what you're working through. Do that over and over again, and you start to condition your brain and body into that new future, into that new self. So you really have to, just as if you wake up in the morning and you're not defined by a vision of the future, or you don't have a goal you're going towards, then most of the time you're going to be reliving the same life, reliving the same
Groundhog
story.
Day.
Yes, because, you know, if you believe that your thoughts have something to do with your destiny, if you wake up in the morning and you start thinking about your problems, and your problems are etched in memories that are in your brain, then most of the time you're thinking in the past. So research has shown that as human beings, we think 60 to 70,000 thoughts in one day. And 90% of those thoughts are the same thoughts as the day before. So the same thoughts will lead to the same choices. The same choices create the same behaviors. The same behaviors will produce the same experiences, and the same experiences will create the same feelings and the same emotions. And the same feelings and same emotions are going to influence the very same thoughts. And what happens then? Your biology, your neurocircuitry, your neurochemistry, your hormones, even your gene expression stays the same. Why? Because you're staying the same.
Wow, that was deep.
We're talking to Sadiq Bakazi. He works side by side with the one and only Dr. Joe Dispenza. And today we're talking about how to use our thoughts to change our reality. And here's a little clip from Dr. Joe Dispenza himself.
Your personality creates your personal reality. That's it. And your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So keep thinking the same way, keep acting the same way, keep feeling the same way. Your personality is the same, and your personal reality will be the same as well. You catch yourself complaining and blaming and making excuses and feeling sorry for yourself, and that's been your unconscious program, then the moment you become conscious of those unconscious behaviors, you're out of the program. To know thyself so well that you don't default back to that old personality.
Your personality creates your personal reality. Wow. Now, Sadiq, I know there are certain things I need to shift. I can feel a heaviness in me. What are some of the tips you can give us? Is there something we can do every day, even if it's something small, just to start, kickstart this?
Of course. I mean, knowledge is the precursor to any experience, as Dr. Joe would say. So I really recommend, if you want to get involved in Dr. Joe's work, you can go on his website, drjoedispenza.com. You'll find all of his meditations. You'll find stories of transformation. But really, personally, what I recommend is start with the books.
What do you do?
Starting with the books, because the books have all the information. Dr. Joe is a New York Times bestselling author. He's written 4 amazing books: Evolve Your Brain, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, You Are the Placebo, and Becoming Supernatural. I would start with the books, really.
So the funny thing is, my friend actually was given a book. She read half of it and left it on the plane, the second plane, the connecting flight. And I was like, oh my goodness, that book was meant to go for somebody else. We'll get you a new one. But you're talking about the books. Can you give us a technique that you've learned from Dr. Joe that you use every day that we could like take on board as well?
You know, like for me, I've been a passionate student of this work for the past 6 years now. And one of the best skills I've learned in this work is, as I said, metacognition, which is in neuroscience, the ability to observe yourself, to become so conscious of yourself in your meditation that you don't go unconscious in your waking day. Mm. So it's not about what meditation to do or which meditation I should start with. It's about really deciding, what do you want to work on? Where do you want to start? You start with that, and you find the meditation that suits you, and then you start from there. So, yeah. And it's not just about doing the meditation. It's about staying in that energy after your meditation, the 15 hours throughout the day. Staying conscious of that new self that you are creating in your day-to-day life, when you're interacting with your colleagues, when you're interacting with your spouse, with your friends. Staying in that energy throughout the day and staying conscious is in what we call the ability to observe yourself, and staying conscious as you're creating that new self.
Yeah, nobody wants an autopilot life, because a lot of us are on that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the programs running the show.
So The Source coming out, tell me a little bit about it and your involvement.
So it's a surprise. It's coming out soon, so I'll let Dr. Joe share that. So it's coming out very soon. So if you want to check Dr. Joe Dispenza's website, you'll see.
It looks amazing. And just finally, what is the biggest lesson you've learned by working alongside somebody like Dr. Joe Dispenza?
I mean, it's such an honor and such a... I feel so blessed to be participating in such a great mission.
And has your life shifted?
Oh my God, incredibly, incredibly. I mean, you know, like just remembering that we are the creators of our life and not the victims of our life, and learning how to think, act, and feel greater than our environment. Thinking, acting, and feeling greater than our body and its sensations. Learning how to think, act, and feel greater than time, and staying in the present moment as much as we can is basically the best thing I can say I've learned in this work, and remembering that we are all creators, and we can all create our lives and create our futures is really empowering, and it moves us into a new level of consciousness, new level of awareness.
Yeah, I was listening to a lot of his Dr. Joe Dispenza's talks on YouTube, but I think the book is what I need to read now. But thank you, Sadiq, for... I know you've been here a few days, and I really appreciate you coming here. And please do come back. We want to learn more.
It's a pleasure.
And good luck with The Source. Now, as you get older, kids, at some point in your life, we're all going to be hit by something that will make us maybe hit rock bottom, maybe just completely question the whole meaning of life, or just wake us up and force us to change direction. And that is exactly what happened to my next guest. With me now is Cristina Guiada Lalicata. She's Italian. And that was my Italian accent, Cristina, whose battle with Graves' disease has turned her into an author and motivational speaker. How are you today?
Hello, Hi, Puma. I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Nice to have you. Now, we've all got a story, and I think the older we get, the bigger the story. So tell me a little bit about yours. Let's go back when you were in Italy and when you moved to Dubai 6 years ago.
Yeah, so everything started when I got sick. As you said, I had this Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune disease which affects thyroid.
So is it an overactive thyroid? Is that
exactly,
what happens?
It's hyperthyroidism. And so it looked like for me you were running a marathon literally 24 hours a day and heart palpitation. You lose a lot of weight. And at that time I was actually happy to lose weight because, you know, it's always kind of that difficult of accepting yourself and your body. So I didn't go to the doctor straight away.
So you're talking about symptoms. You just felt like you were out of breath?
Yes, out of breath, palpitation, you sweat a lot.
Okay.
And
you didn't question that at all?
I did question it by the fact that I was losing weight. I was kind of, enjoying, because I've always had a very difficult relationship with my body.
Because you're very slim. So you'd think that, I just thought naturally you were slim.
I was slim. The fact that losing weight for me was kind of a glorification of myself. So I actually waited 6 months. And it was because I was listening to my mom that then she said, Christina, you have to go to the doctor. And this is where I took a TSH blood test.
Yeah.
And this is where I was diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, but specifically Graves' disease.
So when you heard that, did you know what Graves' disease was?
Not at all.
Did it scare you?
It did scare me, especially because it only affects you the throat and the thyroid, but especially the sight. So my eyes were so big. I was almost staring at people without staring at people. So I was very, very afraid of everything. And you have to go through a very painful process because thyroid is a vital organ.
Yeah.
So you cannot simply, okay, I'm sick, now I get a surgery, I remove it completely and I'm fine. No, there is a protocol to follow because you have to try to take medicine that they will help you to actually restore the functionality of the thyroid. So I went on medication for 2 years. But in my case, there was no option except remove the thyroid completely.
No, my mom had her thyroid removed, but you do have to have a replacement to keep it going, isn't it? Because
exactly.
It's doing all your hormones.
I'm on a pill for life.
I know. That's what happens. A lot of women are. So then did this all happen when you were in Italy before you came to Dubai?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So were you starting to get better once you started taking the medication?
Not really.
So then how come you moved to Dubai if you were feeling...
Because work was calling. So,
you were able to function.
Yes, absolutely.
But what was the
dragging myself.
What was the point where it got really bad for you? Like where you maybe physically or mentally it was affecting you?
It was when, first of all, since for my work I always traveled a lot. I was at risk of thrombosis because the veins, the circulation, the water retention and everything really affected me. So I had to undergo a surgery in 2018 to remove both saphenas, which are the big veins that you have in the right leg and left leg.
Mm.
And then after that, in 2019, since the thyroid was so big, as big as a tennis ball,
in your neck,
I had to remove it. Yes, exactly, in my throat.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, because of this, I always say, you know, there's breakdowns to breakthroughs. What happened to you, which has now led you to write your first book called On a Journey Within Me, Within You?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
So I was on a plane coming back to Dubai, and I had that strong sense of suffocation in my throat. But at the same time, I had this mental suffocation. And immediately, while on the plane, luckily we've got Wi-Fi on the plane right now, I searched for a psychotherapist. And this is how I actually started this journey back to myself, to my very first psychotherapy session. And I have unfolded so many things, so many topics, back to my childhood, my relationship with my father, with my family, questioning myself across the board. And it was then 2 years ago when not only I did psychotherapy, but I also met this wonderful woman, a healing therapist, which is slightly different because a healer helps you really to connect with your spirit. And it's really this connection between mind, body and soul that helps you tremendously to find your inner self. And this journey led me to a self-discovery, self-acceptance, self-love. I never loved myself. before.
Okay, so people talk about self-love. Mm-hmm. When you say you never loved yourself before, what are the different ways you're loving yourself today, the comparisons?
So, for example, I put myself first.
You're not afraid to say no?
Not at all. I now have boundaries, and I'm happy to have boundaries.
Do you think it's something to do with women? Because we're very overgiving, pleasing, nurturing, maybe more than men, and we're more afraid to say no?
I mean, there is a thing, definitely. But for me, honestly speaking, I'm a full supporter of women. But I do believe that also men need to, you know, do the same. And sometimes they may think they're able to do it, but also men, they don't love themselves that much. So
there are a few men out there who love themselves. I can tell. I know a few.
Okay.
But listen, we're going to come back to you, Christina, because I want to talk more about this book. So we'll be back after the break. So with me now is Christina Guida Lalicata. She's Italian. She's not English, which is why her name is so much nicer than mine.
No.
Mine's Indian anyway, so I shouldn't say
beautiful.
Anything. Mine is, yeah, you're right. Now, she battled with Graves' disease. And because of that, you know, like I always say this, breakdowns lead to breakthroughs. She's turned into an author now and a motivational speaker, and she's glowing considering everything she's been through. Now, your book on A Journey Within Me, Within You, what are some of your key messages that you share in this book that you also learned about yourself and you want everyone else to know?
I believe the key message, the most important one, is that even in the deepest darkness, you can see a very bright light. Because imagine you look at the sky and it's full of stars. You don't actually appreciate them maybe fully, but if there is pitch dark and you are in that sadness, in that darkness, if you see even just one little light over there, it's gonna shine and it's gonna guide you out of that darkness. And this is exactly what happened to me, because the disease, the illness and everything and all I went through, even the change from going from 20 years in corporate world and now navigating myself into freelancing in marketing communication. And as you said, I'm a motivational speaker. I'm also an emotional intelligence practitioner. I've recently taken that certification too. And now a published author as well. So it's kind of all new, and it is a little scary sometimes, but I do believe that those are my lights now, and I am following them as much as I can. There are days where I feel very low. Aww. So although you say I'm a smiley, positive person, that's true. I mean, I've changed a lot.
But I think the lows are good because then you appreciate the highs.
Exactly. And if I may give like a little piece of advice, when you to the audience, to the listeners, if you feel low, just sit in that sadness and understand why you feel sad. Go and try to go deep within you, because we have all the answers at the end of the day, and we have to become the best friends of ourselves. It's good to be surrounded by nice people, but ultimately, you have to appreciate to look inside you and find your own answers, which they're going to guide you out of that darkness.
But for many, it's quite scary to go within.
It is.
You're opening Pandora's box.
I know.
And sometimes you want to keep that locked. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, if I may say, you have to be committed to yourself, Puma. And it wasn't an easy journey for me. And it is not an easy journey today for me either, as I said, because discovering yourself, it can be scary, but ultimately it is, you know, through this this journey. I mean, I was reading this message on the elevator this morning while I was going to the gym, and it was saying, for a 1,000-mile journey, it takes always a single step to start. And this is such a powerful thing, you know. So
you're now, because of all this, an accredited emotional intelligence practitioner. What is that?
So, you know, you may be familiar with intelligent quotient, so the IQ.
Yeah.
And the EI, so emotional intelligence, it's a way to utilize emotions in business, for example, but even in your private life, in the right way.
Yeah.
I'm an emotional person, so I've always made emotions at the center of my life.
I'm hypersensitive these days. I think as you get older, I don't know what it is.
I don't know, but I can tell you that I've always been told, don't use your emotion because they can turn, you know, back at you. But it's actually the opposite. If you know exactly how you feel And also when you talk to somebody else, you know, and you try to understand how that person feels, well, is the perfect combination, the right formula for success, because you use IQ and EI together and you make it to a productive way to approach yourself to life. So
where can people get this book?
So the book is available online on Amazon and in different platforms. So it's available globally.
Okay, so it's called On a Journey Within Me, Within You. And we have another one in the pipeline, yes. I hear. What's this book going to be about?
It is about actually my illness. It's completely focused on the thyroid, the second one.
And you did a lot of research on this now.
I did,
and you
yes.
found out, have you got any advice for us about the thyroid? Because for women, it's so important.
It is extremely important. And I advise everybody to do regular checkups because I didn't do it regularly before. Mm. I wasn't even familiar with the thyroid. So I definitely didn't listen to my body, because listening to our body is, the body speaks to us, talks to us. So it's so deeply important. Sometimes we say, oh, I don't have time to go to the doctor because I have to do this, I have to do that. But I am an example that if I would have listened to my body, maybe today I would have had my thyroid. But since I believe that everything happens for a reason, nothing is by chance, my voice was trapped and there is no coincidence that I got sick exactly in my throat.
Well, it's the throat chakra, isn't it?
Exactly.
And basically you're holding back your truth and the universe is like, let's do something. So we open this heart chakra and now you're just writing books.
Exactly.
You went from being completely silent to like completely writing.
Exactly.
And you were forced to do it. It was part of your path.
That's why the book was channeled through me from the universe and I delivered it in 6 days, which was crazy.
That's how I used to write songs. I wake up and they're coming through me.
Oh, you're a songwriter. That's amazing.
And that's how they should be, because they're coming to you naturally. It's not like you're being forced. So it's a message. So I'm so happy for you. And what's the response been like?
Very good, to be honest. And the most beautiful messages I'm getting is that since the title is On a Journey Within Me, Within You, I don't want to sound pretentious that I want to force people to reflect themselves on what I'm doing. But actually, people that are reading it, they say, this is Christina's journey, but this is a book I can actually keep on my bedside, reading it every day and personally find myself in her journey, because this is actually my own journey. And every time I will open that book, I'll be a different person, because today I'm the woman that I'm today, but maybe in a week, in a month or a year, and I read that book again, I will find myself in a different way, because I'll be a different woman, a grown-up. So,
well, where can people see you online? Because I know that you put your book up there too. What's your Instagram page?
It's at CriGuida, CriGuida.
Okay. Christina, thank you so much for sharing
your
story.
Thank you.
And I do like your positive vibe, even though you get low occasionally. We all do. It's part of being human. Flora Castillon is a mindset coach and a limiting belief specialist and is in the studio. Flora, can I ask you, do a lot of us have a limiting belief when it comes to how much time we actually have?
Well, I think if you think of most people saying, I'm not having enough time, I don't know how to fit it in. So yes, our approach to time is flawed, because we are allowing so many disruptions today through the lifestyle we have of hyper-connectivity to just go, I just don't have time. But actually, our approach to it is not quite right. Yes, it's an illusion because we've created it as humans, but you still have to be at school at a certain times and things like this.
So if you think, you're right, because when we go back, we've always had 24 hours in the day growing up. So where it's not like we've had less time, it's how we're using it, isn't
it? Exactly. And if you think about it, we spend almost 11 hours in front of a screen now. So if you add 7 hours of sleep, that's 18 hours. So it leaves you with, 6 hours for the rest of everything. So that's one thing. Most people spend at least 3 hours on emails a day. And most people pick up their phone at least 96 times a day.
Oh.
Right? So when people say
that, we sound like robots. Do you know, when you say that, we actually are
it's
slaves.
It's an addiction and a slavery
we're slaves
to
technology. It. That's exactly what we're turning into, the way you just gave those stats.
Yeah, and they're scary. But the good thing is that we can completely change our attitude to it. But if you think about our sort of almost victim approach to it, I can't, I don't have enough time, I wish I could, or even the way we prioritize our life, we'd say, I hope I can put the kids to bed tonight. tonight. I hope I can go to the gym. And I love this expression, which is like, hope is not a strategy. Mm. Like, you've got to schedule your time in a smart way, but you also have to change your perspective to time on, I'm going to create time for myself. I actually have enough time for the things that are important. That's like the dialogue that needs to change.
You know, there's this thing that somebody said once. Oh, I can't even remember what it is. And I've done it a few times. And they say, imagine that you want to slow time down. So I was driving somewhere and I was like, I'm going to be late. Say, no, I'm going to get there on time. And it was weird. I got there on time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's you're creating what you want when you think in a more positive way. Like, we did have a conversation regarding Dr. Joe Dispenza's theories earlier today at 2 o'clock. But there is something to it. If we say we don't have enough time, that's what we're creating, right?
Yeah, you're basically uploading like a computer directions and directives of, I have time and therefore I create time, right? So your mind is like, okay, we're going to do this. If you give and that's what, you know, Joe Dispenza say, and a lot of people around the subconscious and the belief system, you create your reality through your words and images. Yeah.
So, you know, when the phones first came out, I remember I had a little flip phone. The only thing you could do really was call.
Yeah.
Okay, or the odd text, that was it. I think society completely got lost when we made phones where you are contactable 24/7. That's when it went crazy.
Exactly.
And pictures and emails and this and that, where your whole life is.
But the thing is, the phones are amazing because they save us time if we use it the right way. The problem we have is that we allow us for buzz and notifications and expectation of our partners, our friends, our bosses, that we are available all the time. But there's actually a little thing on the phone which is airplane mode and no notifications. And that's something that everyone can choose to really look at and adapt, and we can talk about it more.
So what does this do to us then, this feeling of limiting time? Is it draining us? Is it burning us out? I mean, are you seeing a lot of clients with these issues and trying to find ways how to create boundaries, basically?
Absolutely. I work with so many different people. I work with a lot of people in events because it used to be my old industry, and I was in an industry where you had to work around the clock, and that's cool and that's good.
Yeah.
When actually I'm like, no, you can still have limit and have boundaries. I work with, you know, CEOs, and I literally relook at their diaries with them. And that's a tip I would give to people, is look at your diary and start putting in your diary your self-care time. And if it's 20 minutes in the morning, it's 20 minutes in the morning. But why are you going to defend a meeting at work and show up for it, but not show up for that 20 minute for yourself? Because you're not visualizing it, because you're not plotting it. You do have to schedule. It's not a control freak thing. It's a way of mapping and visualizing your time so you can see that physically you can do this. And it's making choices.
I think it's prioritizing. You said something really good. You just said, so you can make time for this meeting, but you can't make time for your 20 minutes in the morning. And that's like me. I'll be like, oh, do I really want to go swimming or to the gym? But yeah, I should just go to this meeting, and I will put that ahead of everything.
Yeah.
But you're right. If I can make time for that, why am I not making time for me?
And can I add something to this? So you're in the morning thinking that, right? And you're like, having this mini debate with yourself. You already will do
it. Wasted 10 minutes.
Unless, yeah. Those 10 minutes, you could have actually done something for yourself. But because we give ourselves the options to choose all the time, instead of saying, tomorrow morning, that's what I'm doing. Mm. I'm going to do this and I'm sticking to it. But one of the key things is that we wake up and we consume before we actually create stuff for ourselves. The morning is the best time for most people, but the evening can be the best time for other people who are more night owl. But it's like, you need to set up yourself for the day in a way that you can be productive. So if, you know, they're saying that 80% of people, the scientists have researched and all the data, we look at our phone the first 15 minutes in the morning. What is the issue with this? You're consuming mediocrity on Instagram, potentially. You are pulling all those ideas in your head. You're seeing your email from your colleagues in the US, and you're like, oh, I need to answer to them. Like, it's just, we're adding all of this thing, and this is adding overwhelm, overstress. You know, we're overstressed, we feel burnt out, we feel invaded. It's invasive. So I'm not saying, you know, don't use Instagram, don't go on social media, but have times to answer WhatsApp, times to answer social media. And, you know, it's like, it's not just the phone. Think about the office, how we let people walk in the room. I mean, you're in a studio, right? So people have less of that choice. But it's like, oh, yeah, your boss knock at, oh, just 1 minute, 1 minute, Floja. Can I, yeah, but I was writing something super important here and I needed to be focused and you have been interrupting me. We need to block time for focus. We only have 4 hours a day of actual strong intellectual capacity to develop strategy, to create things, to, you know, do the really deep work.
And it's interesting because when I was younger, all I did was create. I would create music, I would make clothes, I would read books, I would see my friends. It was all about how can we be creative, because we didn't have the internet to entertain us, apart from, you know, a few channels on TV, until obviously Sky TV came and it became massive. But we were so creative and imaginative, all of us.
I know, but I also want to kind of challenge that.
Please do.
We have a choice.
Yeah, you're right. We do
have a choice. I choose to make time for this. I choose to create.
You say that, but you know, I still don't go anywhere where people will still, and I'm guilty of this, we'll put our phone on the table if we're having dinner. None of us, we've all got it in our pockets or somewhere around, like there's an emergency going to happen. But what, 10, 15 years ago, I never carried a phone and I never stressed there was an emergency. But now you're like, just in case.
I think it's about managing expectations, right? If we're training all of us to answer within the next 10, 30 minutes, 1 hour, you know, I was guilty of this. Oh, you've got to answer to your partner throughout the day. Mm. Well, yeah, but you're actually working and doing stuff. So if we say, hey, I'll answer to you when I can. If it's an emergency, here is our little way of doing it. Or give me a call or ring me.
Well, it would be like, that's the restaurant's number or that's the hotel's number. That's how it used to be. You know, and that worked all the time.
But coming back to this, it's creativity. We have to be creative with time. Like, I have a client, he's literally doing squats as he's, like, you know, boiling his coffee, right?
Well, you know,
But that's great because he does it every day now.
But here's the thing, while I'm talking to you, I could get some, you know, weights and do this with my arms because they're not doing anything. I could get creative and stay fit and talk at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, you might struggle to focus a little bit. I mean, I'm not quite sure that's the best advice, people. But what I'm trying to say, there's a lot of small activity you're doing in your life every single day, that habit you're having. You're washing your teeth every day. Why can't you have a 10-minute routine in the morning that is a no-brainer? That's what you do when you fall out of bed. And I know a lot of parents, because I also have a lot of clients that are parents, would let me, yeah, but we have the kids jumping. Okay, well then set your alarm, ideally most of the time, 10 or 15. 20 minutes earlier, and when it doesn't happen because a kid is sick, it's okay. Just be kind with yourself and promise yourself you're doing it tomorrow. It's because people think, oh, if I failed once, then I can't keep an habit. And also, we're thinking that taking care of ourselves is this like massive task. I'm like, I'm going to go 5 times to the gym. Don't start putting expectation that you're not going to meet. But if you say to yourself, I'm going to do that walk or that stretch for 10 minutes every day, I don't look at my phone. My phone is on airplane mode and there is that that special calls. If you have an emergency for 3 people, it still comes through. Then you get into this habit of managing your time. And most of all, you create time for you. Therefore, you don't feel you've been happed by the world, right? Yeah. You haven't been giving before you've been creating something for yourself. Yeah. So I generally think we have a choice. Look, I have been hooked on my phone like everybody else, but I can tell you that in the last few months, because I'm researching time a lot now, I'm really passionate about this topic, I switch off my phone at 8 p.m. pretty much all the time unless I'm out and I need, you know, taxis and stuff like that. And I don't put it on the first. I've got a half an hour routine in the morning that I do seriously. I have a 10 minutes version of it in case I can't do it, like all. And I switch off my phone only after that. You know, and the peace and the calm and the grounding you get is amazing. So let's stop allowing disruptions in our life. And people say, yeah, but my boss, but this is like, block in your calendar. If you're a morning person or an afternoon, block time in your calendar, which is your thinking time. Put a sign on your chair at work. Like, I've done all of these things. Put a sign on your door saying, not to be interrupted for the next hour. Be creative. Like, find ways of putting things that matters to you and protecting your focus. Because the last thing I would add there is you're constantly unsatisfied and not getting things done.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly stopping and starting. So you get excited by the next new shining thing that's just popped on your phone and you're going another direction. But yet,
okay, so we're going to come back with Flora Klastina as she's saying we need to create before we consume, especially in the morning. So Jane says, do you actually have any morning rituals you can share with us or any tips on how we can start managing our time better and starting our morning better?
Yeah, so the idea of mornings is, as I said, start small, right? Don't go, oh, I'm going to give myself a 40 minutes routine to start with. You could say, okay, what can I do in the first 15 minutes of me waking up that feels good to me? It needs to feel good. So I'm going to be really practical here. It could be lighting a candle and doing a few breathing exercises. You could go and get your coffee and sit in your favorite armchair and look outside the window. It could be reading a book you like. It could be stretching. I think mobility in the morning is really important, even if it's 2 minutes of movements and stretching when you're boiling your coffee. I keep going back to this example. But find things that bring you joy, right? Not the thing that you've seen on internet that you've got to do. Do this thing that connects with you. And it's different from absolutely everyone.
Yeah, I have friends that love journaling in the morning and at night. So it's different for, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but a lot of people are online are going to say, well, I don't journal. I don't even really know what it is. You know, I thought journaling was weird for years. So, you know, because I didn't understand the value of it. But it could be that it's someone who goes to the gym for their first 30 minutes. That's what they do in their morning. That's them. It makes them happy.
Yeah.
And what you can do is you can do things in snippets. So you were talking about me. Mine is a little bit, but it's very mine. That's the point. It's personal. You know, I only discovered breath work.
Oh, that's amazing. Breath
work. You know, I mean, discovered, I've known about it for years, like most people, and then you get around to do these things later on. But for me now, I do my 3 gratitude in the morning. My phone is on airplane mode, by the way, from 8 p.m. at night, and I haven't lost any friends or any business out of it. I then wake up, and I don't even get out of bed, right? I literally say, okay, what am I grateful for? And I just pick 3 things. It could be the smallest thing that happened the day before, someone I love, you know, like, it doesn't have to be a major achievement.
Yeah.
So already you're doing positive thinking, right? And positive thinking is important because it's regulating your system that is not thinking, ah, we're freaking out, we had thread, there's lots of problems in life. Mm. So it's literally as you're opening your eyes. And then the next thing is I do breath work myself in an infrared sauna that I have at home, which is this portable thing I bought on Amazon because I got sick at some point, yeah. And I was given that, and actually I love doing it in there. I don't do it every day, but I do my breathing work every day. And to really give hope to people, I would drag my feet for 10 minutes meditation or breathing exercises. Now I do up to 28 minutes and I love it. And the 28 minutes feel like 10 minutes because I've always been challenged with anxiety as a de facto pattern since I was a kid, and I've worked on my limiting beliefs about this. But I know I can still be triggered at times. And for me, the breathing is super grounding. And because I'm a morning person, I don't do the gym anymore. I do a couple of stretch.
No, I don't do morning gym.
I do in the evening because my brain is working great in the morning. So then I go straight to do that key work first. And that gentleman I was telling you, this CEO I was working with recently, and he loves it, said to me, I wake up. First, he was waking up in the middle of the night with his phone responding to emails. Now we've moved on to he doesn't want to talk to his wife about work. They work together. They doesn't want to talk about it
yeah.
in the morning. He's actually going for walks. He's actually listening to music, which he loves. But the most important thing, he said, oh, yeah, I start my day, I do my emails because I work with the UK and I'm clearing my inbox and I'm dispatching. I'm like, but you're a morning person. Your brain is working at that time. And you've told me you haven't written this strategy for the last 3 weeks and it's guilting you out. So now he's blocked in his calendar. For him, it's 8 to 10. 8 to 10, no one is having a meeting with him apart from the rare expectation.
Yeah.
And it has grounded him so much. And he's moved checking all those emails to the end of the day as an admin, right? When his brain is less functional. I mean, the feeling of achievement that you get.
So you're achieving the same, if not more, but you're not draining yourself by the end of each day.
No, you're achieving more, for sure.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, because suddenly you're focused.
Yeah.
He turns off all his stuff now. I mean, it's someone who was a work, like, obsessed
workaholic.
Person. Always, yeah, I always don't say it properly. So I didn't
workaholic.
Go but yeah. But, you know, and now he sees the value.
Yeah.
And he's calmer and he rocks up at work and he doesn't feel overwhelmed.
But I find there are so many people, especially here, that workaholics. I went back to England. Everyone's like, why do you feel like you always have to be busy? And I think it's just depending on your environment too.
Yeah, in your industry and the badge of honor of you should always be you know, working. But then the problem is you start blending work and life so much that you don't go see the benefits of, hey, I can work from home and therefore I lose my commuting. You just see, okay, now I have more time for work. You don't look at it as I have more time for myself. And then it's blending over, right?
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up. I'm so sorry. We'll have to extend this conversation when Helen's back with you, Flora. But thank you so much coming in. And turn your phones off on airplane mode like Flora does from 8 p.m. So they say never judge a book by its cover. And that applies to my next guest, because with me now is Joanna Brogan. I met her a few days ago. And when I saw her, I thought, oh, she's so sweet looking, dainty, so young. And then she told me what she did. And I was like, what? She is a mechanical engineer and she teaches women all about cars. That's right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here. And thank you for helping raise awareness about like this important topic.
Oh, you're going to help us save money when we go and get car salesmen trying to rip us off. That's what I'm hoping you're going to help us with. So first of all, let's go back a bit. Mechanical engineering, is that something that the parents said you need to do, or is it something you actually had a passion about?
I would say it's a mix of both. I mean, coming from a Middle Eastern background, you don't really have options in terms of what you should study. You've got law, medicine, engineering, and business. And I've always liked hands-on work. I mean, my father always called me over to fix things in the house, and that kind of sparked that fixing things and learning how things work aspect. So when I was looking into the different fields, I just found that mechanical could be the most hands-on, which is why I pursued that.
So where did you study it?
I studied in Toronto, Canada.
And when you were doing it, was there a fair amount of men and women on the same course, or was it predominantly men?
It was predominantly men.
So did you feel like you had to prove yourself more?
Honestly, yes. I had a lot of challenges. I mean, even asking questions, it kind of looked like I was trying, you know, I would hear things like, oh, she's just trying to get answers from us. But it was truly me just trying to understand how to solve the homework that we had. But especially when there's not a lot of women, and they definitely judge much easier being in that industry.
Why do you think a lot of women don't go into mechanical engineering then?
I think it's a bit intimidating. And if you think about it, what are you going to do next?
Well, what did you think you were going to do next once you'd done that?
Honestly, I did not know.
Most of us are just trying to get by through life. None of us really know what we're doing, I'm telling you right now.
Just going with the flow.
Yeah. So then, okay, so once you did graduate, then what did you do?
Honestly, let's talk about while I was in school, because that sort of led me to what I did next. While I was at school, I was hands-on a lot. So we did these co-op internships programs, and it sort of helped me understand what I like and what I didn't like. And it was a specific summer. We had these car shows happening in the area, and I had a lot of problems with my car at the same time. So I started to get to know my car a little bit more. So that's when I knew hands-on work is definitely the thing that I want to do. So after graduation, I ended up going into testing in automotive. So I was hands-on in a warehouse with steel boots on every single day, testing parts at different temperatures on and on again. So that really helped.
What? And that, I'm assuming that was all men there.
Yes, I was the only female on the team.
Did you feel comfortable? Like, because here, if you think about it, when we come to work, you know, much of it is working, but you also socialize with the people around you. Was it easy for you to have that kind of social banter?
Definitely. I mean, I was very lucky to have such an incredible supportive team.
Great.
Even from my manager down to my teammate in the group, they were always so supportive, answered every question without any sort of look or judgment. So that's one thing I recommend, is just don't look at the title. Also look at the team you're going to be working with, because it could definitely affect how you perform at work.
Okay. So what do you know about cars? Just tell us, because you know a whole lot. And I'm not just talking about changing tires, because she can actually do that too.
Well, I tried to do all the maintenance by myself, honestly. And it really started from my mechanic with a lot of problems with my car. So we'll get into that in a little bit.
Okay. So tell us, you decided to start workshops, is that correct? For women specifically?
Yeah. Let me take you back to how that kind of came into place.
Okay.
I was driving my car and ran into a flat tire and managed to get it to the shop. This is before I knew anything. And I was standing next to the mechanic while he was fixing the tire. And all I could think about is, I could have easily done this if I knew what I had to do and if I had the right tools. Mm. And he made me pay $70 Canadian. This is, to me, was very expensive, especially as a student. So that kind of started triggering something for me. And then we went in for more problems for my car, as I mentioned. And I actually asked my mechanic, I'm like, can you just teach me how to do the oil change. And I had another issue, and he was like, you know what? Here's the parts. Go on YouTube and do it yourself. And that was the first job I've ever done, and I actually filmed it and put it on YouTube. And that's when I learned, like, something that sounds so scary, like changing the spark plugs or your oil change, is actually very simple once you take the time to understand what's going on and what tools you need to do the job.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be back with Joanna very shortly. If you've got any questions about cars, we're going to be talking about her workshop too. So Joanna Bragan, she's a mechanical engineer who has a passion for cars, and she started an initiative called Girls Mechanic Team. So what happens in this workshop?
Well, we first start by getting everyone to bring their cars in, and we cover everything from the basics. So we do a 360, talk about the fluids, where the spare tire is located, what happens in certain situations, like getting a flat tire. We also do a session on an oil change, not necessarily because people want to learn, but just to educate them at what goes on during an oil change. We do some tips and advices when dealing with mechanics, and we kind of share our own experiences and what we've learned with our vehicles.
So the one thing I know for a fact is whenever I used to go and buy a car in England, I would never go without a man, which would be my dad or my brother.
Yes.
Because I used to think I am getting made a fool of, right?
Right.
Is that true? Do they kind of take advantage of women?
I would say yes. I mean, it's much easier to take advantage of someone that does not know what's going on.
Give me an example of like where you've seen this.
Well, starting with my friend here in Dubai, actually, she had a problem with her engine because it was overheating. And I just looked at the bill afterwards from the dealer specifically, and a coolant, just to top off the coolant, they charged her around 400 dirhams, and that's four times the cost of just getting that outside of the dealer.
So give us some tips if someone's going to buy a car, anything we should watch out for or definitely ask.
Definitely. There's a few things. So when you do buy a car, you do have to understand what the maintenance costs are going to go into it afterwards. Mm. So the more expensive car you get, the more expensive the maintenance will be. So understanding that will definitely help you get the right choice. Second, understanding what is in your warranty and the service package. I mean, if you do any single modification on the car, that could completely void out the warranty. And understanding what service is included so that you don't have to go and do it yourself and pay out of your own pocket. And one thing as well, like, try to understand what can be done by yourself. I mean, that's going to save you a lot of money, topping off your windshield fluid, topping off your coolant, any fluids you can just buy and top off yourself. Mm. Air filter is another one. It's very easy to change the cabin air filter.
Oh, is it?
Yes. Okay. So all it takes is just going on YouTube or coming to my workshop to learn the basics.
So how much money do you think we spend if we can learn 80% of what the mechanics do?
I mean, just taking in that a dealer just charged four times the price. So you can even keep that in mind and understand.
So I'm sure the tools and items that you keep in your car are very different to mine. Mine are usually water, snacks, chocolate, a blanket, and obviously you've got the spare tire. What yes. are some of the most urgent items or must-haves in the car when you're traveling?
Definitely. So a spare tire, of course, making sure that you have one and that the pressure in the spare tire is good, because a lot of people just leave it and it kind of gets low on pressure.
But is it right a spare tire should only be used temporarily and then you got to get it properly fixed? You can't drive with it for long hours.
Definitely not. And not at high speeds either. So yes. you want to stay at low speeds and just try to get to the mechanic to fix the tire. Mm. A tire inflator is a lifesaver. If it's not for you, it's for somebody that's stuck on the road. So if somebody has a flat tire, you can just stop and help inflate the tire for them. Mm. A tire pressure gauge that just helps understand, especially for older models, that there's no sensor and an automatic screen that tells you the pressure of the tire.
Yeah.
So those simple little things can save a lot of money. If you want to go the extra mile, you can get an OBD scanner, which is onboard diagnostic scanner. If any dashboard symbol pops up, you can actually scan that and understand what the problem is. So when you go to a mechanic, you already have an idea of what he's going to be talking about.
Would you love to work for an F1 team?
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, I can see you being
the adrenaline.
Yeah, I can see the way you're talking, and like, I was like, yeah, I could see that happening for you.
Yes.
I was going to ask you, your fiance is here with you, right?
Yes, he is.
So my best friend, she basically, she's a great driver, and when she drives with her husband, he has no clue how to parallel parking. He's the worst person. So whenever they drive and they come to a parking space, she has to get out the car and they swap and he does it. Do you have to teach your fiancé anything or does he know what he's doing?
No, I think he knows what he's doing.
It'd be great if he's sitting in the car and you're changing the tire.
Yes. Honestly, I need all the men to be a bit more supportive. Let your woman take lead. I mean, if she's stuck on the road or if you're at the gas station, show her how to do everything because you don't always have to take charge. And she doesn't need to know these things perhaps to do it herself every single time, but that confidence is transferable to every aspect of your life.
I absolutely agree. Joanna, thank you so much. Tell everybody where they can contact you if they want to join the workshop.
For sure. So you can reach me on my Instagram at Joanna Bergen, or you can check out the website, Girls Mechanic Team. Just Google that and you'll find all the details there.
There you go. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan. Groundbreaking science, life-changing nutrition.
Oh, it's Poonam with you again this afternoon, filling in for Helen. She should be back on Friday. But in the meantime, I am taking over the airways for her and keeping her seat hot. And with me now is Dr. Inam from Whiskers and Wags Clinic. That is in Al Safa. How are you doing today, Doctor?
I am very good, alhamdulillah. How are you?
Very good, thank you. So how are the pets doing during Ramadan? Is it a quiet one at the veterinary clinic or is it still busy?
I would say in Ramadan, it does get quiet, but we are still getting the pets and we are still helping them and the pet parents, and we are still trying to make everyone happy, pets and the pet parents both.
Okay, so where are you originally from, Doctor?
I am from Pakistan.
Okay, so did you always want to become a vet? Did you always have a love for animals?
I always had a love for animals. You know, like living in Pakistan, which is an agriculture country, we always have a very, very close contact with the animals. Then I had this passion of the medicine in me, like all the time. And then, you know, in our Indo-Pak area, your parents always want you to be a doctor as well. And they also.
Yeah, I know.
you
got close. You got really close. You're a doctor to some nice, lovely, cute little pets and animals.
Yeah,
Not complaining human beings, you know. So you did
It's always like it's very emotional, you know, because they're pet parents and you're kind of dealing with the children. So it all gets very emotional all the time,
But this is the thing. I think anybody in healthcare, whether you're a vet or whether you're a doctor or nurse or whatever, I don't have the heart to take care of somebody's health because I get very upset if I can't help or solve or fix them or make them better. How do you cope with that? Because that's very emotional for you in your you know, career.
Yeah, it is very emotional because when the pets come to us as well, like we also consider them like as the children, and they do behave like children as well. So what we try to do is like we try in within our expertise, we try to provide them the best diagnostics and the best treatment care and the best patient care. We try to make sure that once they come to the clinic, they feel as home as possible, and we try to fix the disease, try to fix the problem like as quickly as possible, and just try to make them as comfortable as possible in our facility.
We've had a lot of vets who have said to us, you know, when I say to them, so do you have any pets at home? And they'll say, yeah, we've got eight. I'm like, eight? And usually it's the ones that have come into the clinic that don't have a home or there's something wrong with them. Can I ask how many pets you have, if you have any at all?
I have a cat called Jerry.
Oh.
Yeah.
Just one cat.
So it's a cute little tomcat. And it keeps all of us very happy.
And was Jerry part of your one of your clients, your patients, or you just went and adopted him?
I went on and adopted him, basically.
Oh, bless. Okay, well, Jerry's in good hands. He's got a doctor and a dad, stroke dad, all the time, 24/7. So we're going to go through some texts. We're getting a lot of texts coming in for you. So let's see what we can answer. So let's start off with Ronnie. And Ronnie says, we've adopted a stray cat. Now, our daughter loves him very much. And we did take him to the vet for the anti-rabies jab and a proper checkup. But he has bit my daughter three times already. And bear in mind, before adopting this cat, he'd already bitten her. So we gave our daughter an anti-rabies shot. Do we still need to give her another one now that he's bit her again? And why does he keep biting her?
We need to see like how old the cat is. Sometimes when they're kitten, I suppose 3 to 4 months of age are like this. They have this kind of habit of biting into things. They like to explore. and they do that. But if it is an older cat,
yeah,
right, let's suppose it's greater than 1 year of age, we need to see, like, is it like showing a general aggression towards the people or not? So sometimes it can be a behavioral issue also, because a cat has been adopted. It was a stray cat before. So it can be that that the cat is still trying to adapt into the home environment, because in the outside environment, they have to deal with a lot of hostile cats around, and they're always fighting and trying to basically survive outside. And this behavior usually takes a bit of time to just go away.
Considering
that extra rabies jabs are needed for the cat or not, they are not needed. The rabies vaccine is given once per year, and the immunity lasts for an year. And they have done a great job by giving the rabies vaccine to their
daughter.
That's a great job. But considering this, we need to answer this question, that does this cat behave in the same way with the other people as well? Because sometimes there's also a possibility, let's suppose a younger daughter, and they're trying to play with the cat, but the cat is getting irritated because of something which the child is doing, then the cat will end up biting the cat. So I think all these questions need to be answered, and then we can reach to our final conclusion that which medication we need to give to this cat, or we need to do some behavioral modifications, or we need to get some behaviorists involved in this as well to fix this issue.
Yeah. I know it's hard because, you know, a lot of people here, they adopt dogs and cats and strays. And it's quite a long process because we don't know where they've come from, their behavior, what they've been through. So any top tips or advice for people who are taking in adopted or stray cats and dogs?
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to mention in the previous case as well is that if it is a male cat, the neutering will also help. That okay. If they can get castrated, that will also help to control this aggression. And when it comes to the point that you, let's suppose you're adopting the new cats and dogs, so the things which we need to see is that we just get the complete screening done for them. Like, for example, they are free from the FIV, FELV when it comes to the cats. And when it comes to the dogs, they are free from the Giardia. Okay. And the best is that if the pets which are taken in, they are already neutered or they are already castrated, right? So this helps them to basically blend into the existing family very easily. And if there are previous pets at home as well, they can be easily adjusted into that, considering that these screening tests have been done and there is a very less likely of the disease spread among the pets in the home.
Okay. I hope that helps, Ronnie. Dr. Inam, do not go anywhere. We're just going to go for a short break. And any questions you have for our vet today from Whiskers and Wags Veterinary Clinic. I absolutely love that name. That's in Al Safa. More texts coming in. We've got one here, Dr. Inam from Priya. And she says, I have a 10-week-old kitten that I adopted 2 weeks ago. Super playful and very energetic, except this morning I noticed he wasn't his normal playful self. Now, he started sneezing a lot and then it looked like he was trying to throw up, but nothing came out. So I tried to get him to drink some water. He wouldn't. And now he's just very lazy and he's been sleeping all day. He's also avoiding me and he's sleeping under my bed, which is not common for him. Do you have any idea why he could be doing this? Any idea, doctor?
Yeah. So basically, this is a very common behavior. When the cats become sick, they love to hide under the beds and things when they are sick. So in this case, since the cat is sneezing and the cat is trying to vomit, there can be multiple things. Okay, one thing is that there can be upper respiratory tract infection also going on, which in cats can be caused by herpes virus, calici virus, mycoplasma, and we need to check this thing out. Second thing, since the cat is vomiting, it's a young cat, and I'm considering probably it didn't get the vaccination, or it maybe just got the vaccination recently, probably one shot of vaccine only. So this kitten needs to be taken to a vet clinic, and we need to see do some tests on this kitten to find out that why this kitten is vomiting. And the first thing which will need to be ruled out is something called as feline panleukopenia virus. It's a difficult name, but I will just make it easy, that basically what this virus does is that it attacks the young kittens, unvaccinated cats and stuff, and basically it causes an inflammation in the intestines and it makes them to have vomit. Sometimes the earlier signs are that they will not vomit but they will just try to like kind of retch, and they will try to make like actions that they're going to vomit. So these are the things which you need to check. And I think the best is that since it's a young life and a small little kitten, it should be taken to a vet as soon as possible.
Can they also have reactions to injections when they're that young?
Into certain injections, yes, they can have some reactions as well. Mm. They can have some reactions to vaccines also, but that can happen in any cat, basically. At any age, it can happen, yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Doctor. Simone says, can a vet diagnose congestive heart failure in a dog just by listening to the heart? Is that possible?
Congestive heart failure, you can make... There are many different signs of congestive heart failure. Okay, one of the most... A common signs of congestive heart failure is the higher respiratory rate, or in technical terms, we call it as a dyspnea. So that happens in dogs and cats both, more common in the older geriatric patients.
Mm.
Just listening to the heart, you can, and if there are clinical signs present, let's suppose a pet patient comes to you with a dyspnea, difficult breathing, and you listen to the heart and you listen to a heart murmur, then there are different grades of heart murmur, let's suppose. And then you can have a bit of clue, yes, this cat may have some congestive heart failure, but if you want to reach to a conclusion, then the cardiac ultrasound needs to be performed. And with the cardiac ultrasound, it's just a matter of 10 to 15 minutes, and you can just have a conclusion that this cat or dog is having congestive heart failure or not. And this is something which we do very commonly in the Whiskers and Wags Veterinary Clinic. We provide like the complete cardiac checkup to the cardiac ultrasound.
Mm.
And we do diagnose these cases of congestive heart failure very, very commonly, especially in the cats.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nikki says, my 16-year-old cat has stopped grooming herself and now has several small lumps of tied matted hair on her back, all knotted up. And I'm not able to brush it out without hurting her. Should I now get her shaved?
It again depends. Like, it's a long-haired cat, it's a short-haired cat. And
why would a cat stop grooming herself? Just become lazy?
No, the thing is that when the cats stop grooming themselves, then that also indicates that they are not happy.
Oh, that's like me when I don't comb my hair in the morning. You know, it's exactly the same, isn't it? They're very similar to humans.
Yeah, so basically, when the cat is like, whenever the cats are sick, they're not feeling okay, they will not groom themselves up.
That's interesting.
So again, this thing needs to be checked as well, that why the cat has stopped grooming. And if the hairs have become matted, yes, these matted hairs need to be removed, but under a veterinary care. Because if these matted hair, they are not removed, they can become a nodus of infection, and the bacteria and the yeast and the bacteria and everything is going to grow there, and the cat is going to develop a pyoderma or a dermatitis.
More questions coming in for you. Tala says, my dog has a bald spot. He started chewing that spot one day and all of a sudden I noticed a bald spot forming the next day and it was quite big. Is there anything I can do to help him, or should I just take him straight to the vets?
Bald spots can develop in the pets because of many reasons. All right. So there's a possibility there can be an underlying allergic reaction going on. Maybe it had a contact with some chemical or some other object which caused allergy, and then it started basically the scratching this area, and then that's why the hair may have fallen down. And otherwise, it can be a yeast infection as well. So, and it can be a Demodex infection as well. Yes, I do recommend that he should be taken to a vet to find out that what is going on. And the first step which we usually do in these type of cases is we perform a skin scrap to find out that if there is an external parasite present or not. Some impression smears can also be made to find out if there's a bacteria or a yeast present or not. And then the overall history as well can be also considered, if there's a food change, if there's a change of environment, or something like that. So these things need to be taken into account, and yes, he should be taken to a vet. And if something, just if you have an oatmeal spray at home, which is available from the vet clinic as well, you can just spray on this lesion. That will just create a soothing effect, basically. That's the max you can do at home.
Okay. Has there ever been a case that's come into the clinic or in your career that you thought, I've never seen this before, this is so unique, and it always stands out and stays in your mind?
I think there have been several cases, because we do something in our clinic which is called as our diagnostic imaging.
Mm-hmm.
So we happen to catch the diseases before they basically flare up and they start causing a bigger damage. So we happen to catch the diseases earlier in the stage, before even the pet shows actual signs and symptoms. So I mean, recently we had a case of a cat. It's just the client's complaint was that the abdomen is getting bigger and there were no other signs. Just the cat is just eating fine and stuff. We just put up a probe, an ultrasound probe, and we found out that the cat was developing a mild infection in the uterus.
I thought you were about to say that you saw something in the x-ray where the cat ate something, like a bat or something, or something weird.
These are common things. Basically, we find more uncommon things than, the, than
I know,
that as
but
well.
What have been some of the most craziest things that you've seen pets actually swallow and you've had to sort out?
Oh, I had a dog and this was like a reservoir of the foreign bodies. I took a ball out, I took a plastic toy out, I took like, I think around... more than 10 foreign bodies, different types of foreign bodies, I took out from the stomach of one dog one time.
Oh my God.
And amazingly, this dog had never vomited. And the owner, only the complaint, the owner will tell me that he can smell some plastic from the mouth of this dog.
That dog is lucky to be alive.
And this dog came for something else. It came for the evaluation of the chest. He performed the chest x-rays, and when we looked at the stomach, oh my God, this is full of, it's like a reservoir of foreign bodies.
And he's got a little toy store in his stomach, I think. That's
exactly,
what he's
exactly. And then the other is saying later on, oh my God, my daughter's, this toy is missing, this toy is missing, this toy. Yeah, we found all of them. You can have them now.
Oh my goodness. That is crazy dog. That's funny, actually. Okay, we're getting more texts in again. Dr. Nam is with us still for a few minutes. You can text us on 4001. Now, there's no name on this one, and it says, I have an older cat. She's 10 years old and a rescue, and I've had her for about 6 years. I've just had a one-year-old stray male neutered and added this cat to my household. So he's been around my older female for over 8 months on and off now. And now that he's living actually in the house, he injured her today and I saw some drops of blood. Now she's hiding under the bed. What can I do to make it easier for her? And why is this cat basically trying to injure the older one?
The cats can develop a behavioral thing where they just like try to attack the other cat in the home. Okay. And if this is just a one-time event and these cats have been getting along with each other for a long time, and I think it's just maybe a coincidence, maybe they were just trying to fight for one thing and then the cat just tried to defend it itself and they just like attacked the cat. But if it has been happening for a longer time, then a behavioral consultation is needed to find out, like in the long term, that why these cats are not getting along with each other, and if there is something which can be done to improve this. But in this type of case, if the cat is bleeding, it has developed some injury, then yes, a veterinary care is needed in this case.
Mm. Thank you. Reem says, my dog's eyes keep tearing up and at times there's mucus in it too. So I purchased an eye wash and I've been using it for almost a week, but he still has the same issue. So is it the wrong eye wash or is there something more concerning going on?
Yeah, basically the dogs can develop this mucus in the eyes, and again because of several reasons, and we need to know the history as well. How old is the dog? What's the species? What's the breed of the dog? And is it like an acute thing, at a recurrent issue? In the older dogs, we can develop something. They can develop something which is called as a dry eye. Their tear production basically drastically reduces, and they can develop this mucus production. But that can be diagnosed easily. The test is called as a Schirmer tear test. We just do this tear test and we quantify the amount of tear production which is produced in each eye. So if this is the case, then there's an easy solution to that as well. There's a medical treatment available and there's a surgical treatment also available. In case of the medical treatment, we prescribe some artificial tears and we prescribe some medications to increase the amount of tear production in the eye. In case of a surgical treatment, which is like a permanent one, and in that case, one of the salivary gland duct is basically transferred to the eye, and so that all this saliva basically that goes to the eye and that keeps the eye wet. But there are there can be other causes as well. There may be something happening with the cornea. There may be corneal ulceration. There may be happening something with the fundus of the eye. So we need to do a complete examination to reach to a conclusion that why this problem is happening.
Okay. Dr. Inam, thank you so much for joining us today. And are you back at work or have you got the day off now?
I got a day off now.
Yes. You can relax with Jerry. Okay, so say hi to Jerry for us, and you can find Dr. Inam at Whiskers and Wags Veterinary Clinic in Al Safa. Make sure you tune in to Afternoons with Helen Farmer every weekday from 2 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.